This is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
And this is The Linux Show. We're here. It is, what is it? It's October the 8th, 2002, celebrating the week of our official fifth anniversary of broadcasting live to the world about the latest and greatest of the Linux news going on in the previous weeks. We're real pleased that we finally reached this official milestone to give a few of those of you out there who have not been listening and are relatively new, or this may even be your first time listening to the show. Kevin and I actually started putting this show together very early in 1998. A friend of ours, a guy by the name of Ken Rutkowski, who is presently working for CNET Radio, at the time, in the 1998 time frame, he owned his own network called the Tech Talk Network. And back when our ISP was sold to Vireo, Kevin and I sat down drinking margaritas and eating chips one day, and we were looking at each other, and I'm going, well, Kevin, I'm going to be out of work for a year. What the hell are we going to do? And so we just sort of jokingly came up with the idea of maybe we'd go into the broadcasting business and talk about things in the Linux industry. And so that kernel of an idea sort of launched the process of us getting ourselves organized and doing guest spots on the Tech Talk Network during the spring of 1998. And finally, after doing several guest appearances, they brought us live as a segment on the Saturday Night Show, and we started out doing a series of 15-minute and half-an-hour segments on the Saturday Night Tech Talk Show, eventually worked towards a three-hour-long Tuesday Night Show. The three-hour-long show turned out to be just a little bit too hard. It was just, you know, too much talking and just too much preparation to keep an interesting list of guests queued up. So we backed off to a one-hour and occasionally 90-minute-long show that you've grown used to over the years. So happy birthday to us, our fifth anniversary, our official fifth anniversary. And hopefully a little bit of luck and dodging the Microsoft and the IRS will continue to broadcast for the next 5 years, maybe longer, who knows. So the majority of the crew is here. We are still sort of waiting for a couple people to queue in. But we do have Russ out on the East Coast. Russ, how are you doing this evening?
Oh, hanging in, dodging bullets here in the greater Washington area. Those marvelous sniper reports that have been filling the cable news networks are not very far from me. In fact, my son was working about a block and a half away from one of the places when someone got shot. So,
wow.
It is... I'll tell you, it's weird. It is definitely weird out here.
Yeah, it has to be. I looked at that, and I'm thinking to myself, what parent in their right mind is sending their kid to school that day?
Well, you know, things around here, you just can't stop because of one fellow with a gun wherever this is. This is just insane. It's just insane.
Yeah. Well, if they catch this guy, this is going to be a very dead person. I'm quite convinced.
Oh, yes, indeed.
A lot of very, very, very angry and outraged people in your general area. I can understand completely. Now, we just had somebody link in, and all I've got is phone numbers. I don't know it.
Yeah, this is me. It's Doc.
Hey, Doc.
Hey, man, I'm calling from Denver.
Denver?
Denver, yeah. I'm at Digital ID World.
I thought you said you were in Cincinnati this afternoon.
No, Denver.
Where did I get the idea that you were in Cincinnati?
That was probably me. I got it wrong.
I have never been in Cincinnati.
Well, there's your next
chili there is good.
Yeah, there's nothing there except WKRP.
Right. And it's nothing but the myth, as it turns out. what a break, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm here. As a matter of fact, I was just, for some reason, this is, I don't know why it's even worth bringing up, but a pile of mail sent to my main address at SSC had somehow backed up and sat somewhere since July 17th.
Whoa.
And it all came in yesterday, 1,700 items, and a lot of them meaningful. And one of them was from a guy named Peter Biddle, who works for Microsoft and with Palladium on Microsoft. And I had, in something I wrote for Linux Journal, I said, you know, with on the identity issue, here's a chance for, you know, Microsoft has a chance to side with, actually I was talking about content, you know, the side with the technology side versus Hollywood, and to side with the user versus the big guys. And so he sent a response. This guy, like, he's in charge of Palladium. He sent me a response. And he's here tonight, and he's interested in even coming on the show if you want to have him. But he's up at the top level. Anyway, he's very interested.
You mean he's in your room?
Huh? No, I'm in my room, yeah. I had to come down here because I forgot the phone number. So, and I'm not sure I could have used the cell up there anyway because it's too noisy. There's a reception going on there. But at anyway, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on with Microsoft and Palladium that's moving, they say, in an open source direction. Who knows? But anyway, seems like a nice guy. I'm here. I'm going to be on a couple panels. I'm going to be speaking. It's the first time the Clue Trainers are gathering. All four of us are going to be here.
Really?
For the first time since we wrote the book.
How fun.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And, it's just a bunch of fun people here, and it's there's an open source thing behind it. It's that if you go to pingid.org, you'll see the open source side of pingid.com, which is like, it's like a Jabber and Jabber.org relationship. In fact, it's started by Andre Durand, same guy who started Jabber.com. And they put on their first conference, and it's a doozy. It's really looking like it's going to be great. And having fun with that. And everybody, the main topic here, of course, is the webcasting settlement, which I'm sure we'll talk about tonight.
Yes. Speaking of the Clue Train, the book, I just want you to know that you probably owe me something along the lines of about 7 cents worth of royalties. Because at a very recent event, it goes back about 3 weeks ago here, I was on a panel speaking before a fairly good-sized crowd. I'm guessing there's probably 500 people in the room. And we were talking about dot-com failures and things like that, and I referenced the Clue Train book, and the irony was that all of a sudden the other people on the panel said, oh yeah, the Clue Train book, that's a really good book. If you want to get a clue on the internet. And so all of a sudden they all started talking about the Clue Train book.
And, wow.
And apparently over the course of the next 3 days, every copy of the Clue Train manifesto got bought out of all of the local bookstores.
That's the amazing thing about it to me is that I didn't realize this, but you know, most books do kind of come and go, and Clue Train became canonical. I mean, there's a steady current of them that flows through Barnes and Noble and Borders and those places. It's not what we expected, but it's a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing.
We don't see any money from it, but
well, like I said, you owe me a whopping 7 cents.
Yeah, I owe more than that, man. Believe me.
Okay, well, let's go on to the rest of the panel. Kevin and I are here. Well, actually, Kevin's over there, and I'm over here. We are in the Chicago area, broadcasting live once again, the weekly show. And Arnie, are you on? No, he hasn't called yet. Well, I keep on periodically checking for Arnie. I keep on seeing phone numbers pop up. This one must be Dennis. Dennis, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, we'll be coming to you in just a few minutes, Dennis, but we're going to go ahead and start up the first segment of the Linux show. And, Doc, I think I'll go ahead and throw it to you, seeing as you're at a conference on a hotel phone, just in case you get kicked off. I'll let you go ahead and start.
The cell still works. The main thing, well, there's a lot of stuff going on right now, but the main one is, for me anyway, because it's a topic I've followed for a long time, is the settlement between a group of webcasters and the RIAA, going back, that's been in negotiations since July. I just got a long email from Bill Goldsmith of Radio Paradise and KPIG, who describes it in much less glowing terms than most of what I've read. The good sign is that a lot of stations are going back on the air. Soma FM is going back on the air, but KPIG is not. Unfortunately, it's not a deal that helps them out. You know, radio stations are not used to paying these kind of fees. And you can't tell a radio station owner that they're all of a sudden going to pay to be on the net when it used to be free, and when they don't pay royalties to broadcast over the air. And so that's the end of free KPIG on the air, which is a real shame. But Bill says it'll keep him in the country, and the game is not over. That we need to, you know, continue to push this thing. But basically, he said the deal is exactly what the RIAA proposed back in July, that all the negotiations since then did not budge them an inch. Pretty close to that.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, what a noisy phone. Yeah. But it's, you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if the buzz is coming through on your side or not.
Yes, it is, but that's okay.
Oh, you know what it is? I'm touching my keyboard. Oh, shit. Isn't that weird? Oh, well, I can't. Oh, there, let me open. I just want to read you the last thing that he wrote on his. He said, we were disappointed that so many of the terms and conditions in the final bill were virtually identical to the original offer. Oh, and down at the bottom he says, I found it amazing that a number of the RIAA legal staff would look me in the eye and say that unless we're running tightly controlled playlists of nothing but top big label hits, just like terrestrial radio, they saw no promotional value whatsoever to them in our efforts to promote artists and CD sales. I suspect that they thought that way, but it surprised me that they would actually come right out and admit it. Incredible, huh? Absolutely amazing. Anyway, so that's one thing. The other thing is this conference is around a whole new area, identity has mostly been something that only people who care, you know, work for Visa or the bank and other things like that, they want to do, you know, manage identities in a directory, care about. But the angle that I'm coming from and that a number of people here are advocating is very clue trained. It's fully empowering the customer. So the customer is in charge of all of their identity information. It's not a matter of privacy and protecting themselves from the big companies, but making themselves more attractive to the big companies and to everybody else on their own terms. And those terms need to be worked out and need to be a fundamental internet service. And so that's what I'm going to agitate for here. So that's basically the end of my rep.
Okay. Well, there's plenty of other things else to cover. Why don't we jump over to Russ? Russ, have you got any hot stories the week you want to bring in?
Well, it's kind of an observation more than a story. I've watched Sun and their participation in the Linux area for some time, and I've always kind of wondered whether they would really get on board. And the interesting thing to me is that if you look over at Linux Today, and maybe some of the other websites have it too, There are two stories about two entirely different Sun Linux products that are, you know, making the rounds. One is covered by ZDNet called Sun's Linux PCs Might Just Work, which is an interesting notion in and of itself because that's talking about Linux on the desktop once again. And then one that's covered over at InfoWorld, that's not me, but just someone else at InfoWorld, on the Sun Cobalt offerings, and they're reviewing that. It's very interesting to me. It's encouraging to me to see Sun at least starting to offer some serious products, starting to make some noise about some serious products as well that have to do with Linux. Just how it's all going to play out, I'm still waiting to see.
Yeah, and
I'm
really
encouraged
what,
by it.
On top of the product-related news, what do you think about, and anybody feel free to jump in on this, what do you think about Mad Dog moving his shingle over to Sun?
I didn't know about it.
Sun or SGI? I thought it was SGI.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
I thought I saw something a few days ago.
I was misinformed. I had heard it was Sun.
I may be mistaken, too, because it was several days ago. In fact, I sent him an email, and I haven't heard anything back, which is not unusual considering the massive email that that Mad Dog gets, plus the fact that God knows if he's on this continent or not. I haven't heard back, but I thought it was SGI.
You very well could be. If that's the case, it's just downright bizarre.
Well, you know, I think the bottom line here is that this is, from what I understood, at least from the article I saw, this is similar to the move that he had with BA, which is that he's not supposed to be doing things for SGI as much as he's just supposed to be doing Linux International, and SGI has been nice enough to pay the bill, which considering the fact that he hasn't had anyone underwriting him for many months, last I knew, is a good thing for him, which means...
Last I heard, he hasn't drawn any salary since January or February.
Right. So.
And it was getting a little tight.
I can believe this one, so I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, if nothing else, he can buy kidneys and beans now. Got to keep the guy fed.
Something.
It's pretty bleak when the Linux industry's main trade association can't pay its executive director. I was really, really disappointed in that situation.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. When Linux was a fledgling move, Linux International seemed to get a lot more attention as a way to focus things. Now that the big companies have come in full force, it seems like there is a bit less interest in Linux International because all these people have their own marketing departments, and they say, "Well, we can take care of ourselves." So it's a rough thing. I'm hoping that LI.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Any other stories?
I think that's it for me.
Okay. Well. I've got a couple that I would like to throw out as discussion points. And the first that I'm going to bring up, because he happens to be hanging on the phone already, is we've got on the phone with us tonight Dennis Powell, who is editor-publisher of LinuxandMaine.com, and we have, over the months, sourced Linux and Maine on a number of occasions. Linux and Maine has developed, I think, in most people's opinion, a style at which they place quality over quantity, and they have, on the whole, done a pretty good job for a new news media company. It's very hard to create a media entity and have it survive over a period of time. It's an uphill battle, to say the least. In particular, the reason why I contacted Dennis was there was a series of stories talking about KDE, and in specific, the KDE League, that seemed to me to have originally stemmed from a couple of articles written by Dennis over at Lennox in Maine, and it has started a cascading series of finger-pointing and he said, she said claims, and has developed into quite a little controversy within the Linux community. And so I decided, well, what the heck, let's go to the source of the story and find out really specifically what Dennis was trying to focus and educate his readers about, and then move forward from that point. So Dennis, welcome to the Linux Show, first of all.
Thank you very much.
As a fellow Linux media guy, it's always fun to have other people in Linux news on the show. Of course, I don't have to give you any background on the story. You wrote it, so tell us what it's all about, and what kind of feedback have you gotten from the KDE League, and from, at least from your perspective, what is truth and what is not truth?
Indeed, yeah.
There's some really nasty stuff that's been floating around the past few days.
Yeah, I've learned things about myself that I was not aware of before. This began actually when I got email from a KDE developer who pointed me to a thread on the KDE promo mailing list from back in February. And in it, the KDE League, through its chairman, said that, the initial thread asked, what's the KDE League doing and what's it doing with its money? And the chairman said on a different thread that while he wasn't in favor of saying anything, that he would go to the board, have an official response in a month. And the email I got said it's been 6 months and we haven't gotten any response. So I started doing a little research and so on. And part of that was trying to find out about the KDE League Incorporated Corporation. And so I phoned the Delaware Division of Corporations in the Secretary of State's office, and you have to pay them $10 to find out anything, and I forked over the $10, and they told me that as of March 1st, the KDE League, Inc. had ceased to exist through failure to do some sort of filings and a franchise tax, I believe they call it down there.
Okay, I'm going to stop you for a second right there, just so that we've got the reference points on a chart in front of us, and it's clear to see.
Okay.
Okay, you called on what, approximately what date?
Friday.
This past Friday.
Yes.
So, in October. And,
yes.
And the date that they gave you that the corporation was dissolved through...
March 1st, 2002.
Not March 1st, so that's...
7 months.
April, May, June, July, August, September, October. So this corporation has been dissolved now for 8 months.
Well, 7 months and a few days, I think.
Okay, 7 months and a few days.
And anyway, that struck me as puzzling. and so I looked up, since I didn't have a phone number for the KDE League, I did a who is for KDEleague.org and got an office address and number, called there, found the chairman of the KDE League, Andreas Poor, asked him about it. He didn't want to respond to me, which I noted in the story, put up the story, and that was that. Over the weekend, it was suggested by many people that the story might be in error in some ways. So I went back to him again yesterday at the Delaware Division of Corporations.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you again.
Okay.
Okay, now, I haven't read the whole story.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to ask you one question.
Mm-hmm.
In this first story, Did you insinuate, accuse, in any way, shape, or form, that there has been malfeasance in the dispensation of the money?
No. No. We said that it would be, well, we didn't even say it would be a good thing. We said that if, in fact, what was said about the company being non-profit was true, as the Delaware Division of Corporations said, then they would be obligated to provide what's called a Form 990, which is the way that nonprofit corporations that are given tax-exempt status by the IRS inform people of where they're getting their money and what they're doing with it and how much is involved. And I said that. But no, we've never at any point accused anybody of doing anything malfeasant or illegal or anything else. The one possible, quote, illegality would be the fact that if, in fact, the KDE League is a tax-exempt organization, then they can be penalized as opposed to either fined or charged in court or anything, $20 per day if people request their Form 990 and they don't cough it up. But that's 100% of the possible wrongdoing that we've mentioned even as a possibility.
Okay, well, that's fine. Then continue on from Friday after your first story.
Oh, okay. Well, so there was a question raised about this on the KDE Core DeVell mailing list. And so Andreas Poor responded that it didn't apply because KDE is a not-for-profit rather than a non-profit corporation. Interestingly, the very first sentence of the bylaws of the KDE League Incorporated begins, "This non-profit corporation shall be known as the International KDE League." So there was a little bit of parsing of words here and so on to what end I do not know, and I don't care to ascribe motives to anybody. Anyway, there was enough question raised that on Monday we went back to the Division of Corporations of the Delaware Secretary of State's office and spoke to a Lonnie Fletcher, who told us that, oh my goodness, look at this, I have pulled the thing, it was in the computer all wrong. Thank goodness you called. I yanked it out, and look, here now, here on page 3, sure enough, you are a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, which would mean they are tax-exempt. And so, let me reinstate it, and boom, all taken care of. So, in fact...
So you reinstated the corporation?
Well, apparently, by according to her, by the call, we got them reinstated.
Excuse me for laughing.
which was not our intention. We certainly don't regret it, but I mean, that isn't what I called to do.
Could you check my corporate paperwork too?
That's right. She you know, went on at some length, and I asked repeatedly, "Are you certain that you have the paperwork there that demonstrates that this has been given federal tax exemption as a 501c3 corporation?" And she said, "Yes, absolutely, I have it. It is page 3 of the documentation here." So I wrote up the story that appeared yesterday. But all of this kind of gets in the way of what probably is the issue involved here, and that is whether there is a, legal matters aside, whether there's a moral obligation for a substantial corporation that is heavily involved in and solely presumably at the service of a free or open source software project to be as secretive as it has been. And as these things have come out, various people involved in the KDE League have been sending us all kinds of documents. including one that was sent out just before the KDE League was announced in November of 2000 at COMDEX, and it was kind of interesting in and of itself, in that it mentioned, among other things, that they would be well, let me find the exact wording. And I'm on the wrong story here. That would explain why that's a problem. said that Wednesday morning, before or during Mr. Diakaza's presentation, we will issue the press release announcing the formation of the league. So before they even existed, they were kind of trying to find a little way maybe they could torpedo Gnome just a bit. And then also in that same email was, and this is a direct quote, "As with all other league matters, please keep this confidential," which, I don't know. Does it? Do you guys kind of fly in the face of what you know? Information wants to be free is about.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to become too nitpicky on the way an internal organization works. Personally, in a perfect world, absolutely, I would agree that if you're going to run an open source project, it should be by nature open. Including financial matters. I think, and again, this is not a legal statement. This is a moral statement that can all agree with or disagree with. I don't particularly care. But I think the people who run an open source project and collect charitable contributions. Now, this is different from an open source project funded by a business that's a for-profit corporation. But if you collect donations from the public, and those funds are coming to you for the express purpose of doing open source development, that money better well be spent on open source development. And should your project become inactive or indeed legally dissolved, as what appeared to have happened to the KDE League, in my opinion, you owe a moral obligation to take those funds and donate them to some other active project so that the monies are indeed used towards the purposes of what they were donated for. Now, that's not a legal obligation on the part of that nonprofit corporation. They can keep those funds and, you know, earmark them for salaries or dissolution funds or whatever they want to do with them.
Well, now, a couple of things. First of all, and this is where the distinctions get kind of strange, because, of course, the KDE League is not the KDE Project.
Right.
It is an organization that was founded to promote KDE, and that raises an additional issue. I mean, first of all, no one is saying, to my knowledge, that anything untoward was done with any of the money that was raised.
I'm certainly not.
But, in fact, it just simply hasn't been accounted for at all. And that probably wouldn't raise any questions, except that what gave rise to the original thread that gave rise to the stories is no evidence of the KDE leagues having done anything at all. And, you know, well, okay, it could be that just nobody joined and so on, and that was that. But then I was sent the executive committee's proposed budget for last year, which, when they finally got down to it, was $173,000. That's a not inconsiderable amount of money. I think that a lot of pretty heavy duty open source projects could run for a very long time and send people to trade shows and this thing and that on $173,000. And this included things like $60,000 for a PR firm, but $12,000 for press releases, of which there were to be four, which would be at $3,000 a piece, and given the likely targets of press releases having to do with what these would be, which was the release of a new version of KDE, you could send a press release to everybody with a $50 bill wrapped around it and still not manage to spend $3,000. Then promotional expenses were also a separate item, so we have no idea what $60,000 for a PR firm was about.
Now, be careful of that last statement, Dennis, because it could be interpreted as that you're insinuating that they might try and bribe people.
Oh, no. I was simply saying that $3,000 is a whole lot of money.
I know, but I want to make it perfectly clear.
Okay, yeah, no, that's absolutely right.
That's the
okay.
Vitriol.
Let me recast it in this way. You could take the press releases for everybody that would possibly be interested in publishing a piece about the release of a new version of KDE, and you could have it hand-delivered to them by messenger and still not spend $3,000.
Yeah, yes. That's a much better way. The only reason why I'm clarifying this is there seems to be an oversensitivity going on there. At least that's my observation. For what appear to me to be justifiably raised questions. I have yet to see any evidence that you have, in the words of some people in the KDE League, slandered individual members and the KDE League as a whole. I have seen no evidence at all of that. Now, granted, I will admit, I haven't read your articles word for word. I just sort of scanned over them, and so I could have missed some.
Well, I'd certainly like you and everybody else to read them, because that was certainly not our intention. And in fact, we stand by the facts put forth in every sentence of those stories. And when something is demonstrated to us to be in error, we correct it, as in fact happened 2 days ago when in the Week in Review column we said that there was some grumbling about the GCC shipped with Red Hat 8, and that wasn't right. It was the GLIBC, and somebody drew it to our attention, and we fixed it right quick and thanked them publicly and said we screwed up. So it's what I guess puzzles me, and we had an editorial to this effect today, actually went up last night, is that it seems as if the KDE League is going to a lot more trouble not releasing information about what it's doing and its financial things, but even in fact the things that it has accomplished, if any, than it would be to just disclose the stuff. I can't for the life of me figure out why that would be.
I can't respond directly to that. What I can respond to along the same lines would be that if they spent as much time and effort sending me email accusing you of slander, if they would have spent that amount of effort on keeping their corporate record-keeping in good standing, this never would have happened.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. It didn't take us very long. And I guess, as I understand it, the statement from them is that they didn't know that they weren't in good standing for these 7 months, which I guess is entirely possible. I mean, you don't call up the Secretary of State once a week and say how are we doing?
You know, it is possible for a company or for an organization that is not really operating. Because if you're not checking your mail and you're not responding to your legal agent, and at least in the state of Illinois, all corporations are required to have a legal agent, so that if they cannot get a hold of a corporate officer, there is a lawyer out there somewhere that will respond to the state filings.
Mm-hmm.
And
there is a necessity for a for a, I believe it's called a registered agent.
Registered agent.
In Delaware. But that's because of the fact that, at least as I understand it, it is because of the fact that about half the companies in the country are incorporated in Delaware, and so this meets the requirement of having a Delaware address.
Yeah, well, like I said, that's true to a point. And also, if they don't get a response back from an officer or the legal agent, they presume the company's out of business, and they dissolve it.
Mm.
It's that simple. And so, although I'm not, you know, I'm not accusing the KDE of anything wrong, the plain fact of the matter is their incorporation lapsed, and their incorporation lapsed primarily due to the fact that they weren't paying any attention to their project. And so they should be a little embarrassed about this. And my target on this is I think that's what the issue here is. They're embarrassed. And they're lashing out at you because they don't know what to do to save face.
Well, maybe. I mean, I am very reticent to ascribe motives to anybody.
Well, good. I'm glad you don't, because you're a reporter.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's
I do commentary.
Right. It's just you know that again. It just, you know, looking at the whole thing, that they're I don't know. There's something that just doesn't seem right, and by right I don't mean, or by not right I don't mean illegal or any such thing, but just that boy, it sure seems like things could be a whole lot smoother in a little bit different way.
That's right.
And that would include disclosure in much the same way that for instance, we can ask for source code, and that does not mean that we believe that the binaries are corrupt.
Yep. Yep. So from my perspective, I'm saying this. You guys out there at the KDE League, no one thinks you're crooks. All we want you to do is get yourselves a little better organized. Okay? That's all. You know, well, and enough said from my perspective. Dennis, I'd really like to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Well, thanks for having me here.
It was a great series of stories. And again, in general, I'm really impressed with the quality of writing you do at Linux in Maine. So keep up the good, in-depth work. Not every reporter is willing to lift up the phone and call the Secretary of State's office and make the effort to do good reporting, and I've always been impressed about the that you follow the rules of reporting and really do investigate and check out your sources. So, good for you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. This is the Linux Show for Tuesday, October the 8th, 2002. We're going to take a really short break and come back with segment number two, and maybe we'll sneak a couple quickie news stories in as well. But everybody hang in there. Kevin, put on a tune. We'll be right back.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms. So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.
Yeah. And this is the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show Short Break. Very interesting story, I thought. It's interesting how the Linux media and the Linux organization oftentimes come head-to-head over issues that are really very much ado about nothing and boil down to personality issues. It would be very interesting to see how this evolves out. Does anybody have any more stories before we jump into segment number two? Kevin, you've got any new releases this week?
Oh, yes, there is, in fact, Mandrake distribution for the Xbox out now.
What?
Yeah, I saw that. That's very cool.
Of course, you do need a mod chip to be able to run it, but it is getting closer.
Okay, so this is for the Xbox.
Yep.
Okay. Along with that, do you have any information at all? I'm just mentioning this because I heard this over the weekend from one of my nephews. A couple of my nephews are really diehard gamers, and they've got one of everything. They've got Dreamcast and PlayStation 2, and they've also got Xbox. And apparently, the hardcore gamers, like my nephew, have been significantly hacking the Xbox over the last few months, and there have been a number of things published onto the internet on how-tos to crack the Xbox. And is it true that the rumor floating around, if you even know, that Microsoft is going to completely 100% redesign the Xbox just for the protection of copyrighted material?
Oh, they already have. They have changed the hardware, so you can't easily modify it to install custom software.
Huh. So when did that happen?
A couple months ago.
So are the old Xboxes still available, or have they pulled them back?
It depends on who has what stock. I don't know when the stores actually started getting the new units.
Huh. So that's a done deal, huh? Because my nephew was hypothesizing that you're going to probably start seeing the hardcore gamers start selling Xbox clones using the previous hardware configuration in the pretty near future, because apparently that's the buzz within the gaming community. So, and who knows, maybe this Mandrake release will help them facilitate that. That would be a really interesting thing. Well, let's go ahead and jump into segment number two. If you don't have any more new releases before I step all over you.
No, that's the big one for this week.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and jump in onto segment number two and talk about our projects. At least we'll go as far as we can. Russ, I'm going to let you go ahead and start first with your project. There's really not much to talk about. And in terms of an introduction, I'll let you do it because it's your project and your story. So go ahead, Russ, and take it away.
All right. Well,
Do talk loud, please. People in the IRC are constantly reminding me of that.
Okay. I boosted my phone now. The project is a simple one. It was just a something for me to use at home. That is, I wanted a time shifting box, something on the order of a TiVo, but without the cost, without the subscription, which is a big thing for me. I mean, I don't mind putting out a little money to get a box that will work for me, but personally, I have a hard time paying subscriptions, which when the subscription expires, suddenly the hardware becomes a doorstop. That's not my idea of a good time. And so I decided that I would try to build something that would allow us to do some time shifting of television at home without costing an arm and a leg. And through rummaging through eBay for appropriate parts And I picked up a very cheap Brooktree-based video capture card and started mucking around with it, and I, in a very short order, had a working system. And, in fact, as I sit here, I am actually looking at the box. On the Linux Show webpage now should be the link to a page that I put up on the subject. A couple of photographs, although there isn't really much to see here. It is basically just a small PC that I found on eBay that measures about a foot by a foot and about 3.5 inches deep. It is a Celeron 400 megahertz processor. It is nothing new at all. It's old hardware, but it's small, and that's what I liked.
How much did you pay for the box?
The box cost me, I think, about 80 bucks and about 20 bucks to ship. And one of the problems that I had initially was once I got the box, I found that the PS2 mouse and keyboard were non-functional. And the guy I bought it from was willing to exchange it for another one, but I'd have to shell out another 20 bucks for the shipping. And I basically said the hell with it and went out and got myself a USB keyboard and mouse and just sort of went around the problem. Of course, I did find the problem that Mandrake 8.2 has, where in my case and apparently in other people's cases as well, certain USB keyboards don't play well in the first stage of the installation. As in, not at all. So I ended up having to...
That's a fact, Jack.
Well, I had to hack the installation CD, hack the floppy, which is actually pretty easy to do. I was surprised at how easy it was to do, actually. They have all that capability in there so you can do all these automated installs and whatnot. So I just got into the second stage, and everything was fine after that once X-Windows came up. And the box works fine. I am using cron basically to schedule most of the programming. I'm not really interested inside something that I have to interact with a great deal. You know, a lot of people want to program you know, six different shows this week and five different ones next week. That's not an issue for me. I mean, for us, we just want to capture the certain shows that we sometimes miss and have it there, and I have the box set up so it automatically deletes everything after 7 days. Anything that's more than 7 days old gets wiped off the disk. I have a 60 gigabyte hard drive put in there, which was a trick in and of itself because the BIOS on this machine is so old that it immediately chokes when it sees the disk. And it doesn't matter if I try to lie to it. That was the first thing I tried to do. I've done that before. You lie to the BIOS and say it's only a, you know, an 8-gigabyte drive, but as soon as it looks at the disk, it just dies. So I had to tell the BIOS that there was no drive there, and I had to boot from the floppy. But when Linux boots from a floppy, it goes around and ignores the BIOS and tries to find what it can find in the hardware, and the result is then I could boot off of the hard drive via the floppy, which is a pain.
Did you try upgrading the BIOS?
I actually looked for that. I think I'm at the latest version of it, which is kind of sad. I spent a long time trying to find docs on this motherboard, and I actually had to go to, I think, the site in Taiwan to find something, some PDF files on it. There's actually pretty minimal information out there, as far as I can tell, about the Sahara 2 motherboard. But I found what appears to be an upgrade, but it looks like the number is what's out there now, so I'm not sure that it's going to help.
For anybody attempting a project like this, if you do pick up an old box or an old motherboard like Russ has got outlined here, I want to direct your attention to a website, biosworld.com. It is one of the better resources in the Internet today for tracking motherboard manufacturer-specific BIOS as well as motherboard-specific error codes, and highly recommend that website as a good resource. They frequently have better detail for older product than the manufacturers themselves do, because the manufacturers really like to dump stuff as soon as it passes the legal 7-year support limit. They make all mention of it disappear from their website. So that's a really good resource. And you may want to try that out.
Okay.
Also, just as an FYI, for a lot of box appliance type projects, the motherboards from MSI right now are very economical, low end motherboards that have a lot of onboard utility. In particular, there's one that has an Intel 815 chip set on it that has onboard video, onboard mouse, onboard 5.1 sound, and the price on this board is $79.95 brand new.
Wow.
And it's a really good way for building something that's sort of an appliance because it's got just about everything on board. But Russ, get back to this. How much work did you actually do? How much did you put into putting it all together?
It actually wasn't a whole lot of work. I think I spent some of the most significant time goofing with some of the hardware that wasn't working, like the keyboard and mouse and that sort of thing. And that that isn't really part of the project. That was just trying to work around limitations. If I had gone with a slightly newer box or whatever, or one in better condition, it wouldn't have been an issue. The software was very interesting, and this kind of surprised me.
Bring up the volume.
Okay. The software surprised me because Mandrake recognized the TV capture card right during the install and just installed it right away, no problems. All I had to do to get the TV capture working was to find out what parameters to pass in modules.conf so that it would know what type of tuner was in there, because the driver supports so many different types of tuners. And the thing that I have, quite frankly, is one of these capture boards that was probably built on the boat coming from China. There may have been a name on the box, but it's, not a name that anyone's going to recognize anytime soon. It was just a generic little card that I paid like $40 for at a show. And just by experimenting, I found the parameter that worked well for that card. Everything else was being handled pretty well by the little PC box itself. The final trick for me was getting something that would give me composite video out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have gone with another VGA card that already had that. The VGA here is on board, and just hope that, considering the lack of documentation, that it would simply work with the new card and turn off the onboard thing. That would be nice, but I wasn't going to hold my breath on it. I ended up going with a thing I found on eBay called the TVator Pro, which sent me back about $40.
TVator Pro new has a price tag of about $179.
Yeah, well,
they are really more designed for conference room applications.
Right.
And they're a great product. I own two of them myself. but in this particular case, again, I think if the BIOS would allow it, I would go to, see if I could disable the onboard RAGE chip and throw in a PCI video card that had composite out. That may have given you a smoother edge. Because that TVator Pro, like it says in the article, really does fry the edges of some images. And conference room-style applications really are facilitated to use with these what do they call them, raster scanner converters or whatever they're called, and compensate for the fact that these things don't really address 640 by 480.
Right.
So.
But as it is, and I think I mentioned inside my little write-up, there's only two slots inside this PC, and
yep.
one of them is taken up by the capture board.
Yep.
And I have an eye towards expandability. And one of the things I mentioned, you know, some people said, well, why the hell would you do this? Why wouldn't you just buy the TiVo? And one for me is the business about putting out a fee just to use the damn thing and then inheriting a boat anchor or having to hack the box if TiVo should decide to get out of that business. But the other thing is to be able to do some things that a standard TiVo can't do. And for me, having the expandability in there is important because I already set this thing up so that I should be able to burn VCDs out of these things should I really want to. It is networkable, and in fact, one of the I have an Xterm open on it here from my box sitting in front of me.
Is it noisy?
Excuse me?
Is it noisy?
Noisy in terms of sound or...
Yes.
No. Actually, it's got a teeny tiny fan in the back that, in fact, I remember when I first turned it on, I had to put my hand over it to make sure the fan was working because I really couldn't hear it. But it's there and it's moving, but it's a very quiet box.
Yeah.
It's very quiet.
Kevin, give me an opinion on this. Do you think a 400 megahertz Celeron... would run with heatsink only and no fan?
Maybe.
Because I know AMD 350s that I've tried in similar applications will run just fine without a fan to keep them quiet. But I don't know if a Celeron is that cool.
Well, I know the processor, the 400 megahertz processor, does have its own fan, and then there's a fan for the box.
Yep.
But I'm not hearing either of them. I mean, I'm sitting, maybe 6 feet away from the unit, and I hear nothing.
Oh, that's good.
Absolutely
that's good.
Nothing.
And really, that's the best thing to do for projects like these is keep the power down on the CPU so you can keep the box quiet. Let's talk about software again for a moment.
Oh, sure.
You wrote a little script that you described. In the article, did you happen to check out at like SourceForge? And Kevin, if you want to comment on this, because you've played around with time shifting devices, regardless of what the Vulcan High command may say, you can't shift the time. But anyways, did you check on any websites like SourceForge to see if there was anybody coming up with GUI-driven scripts for these kind of time-shifting devices to control capture cards?
I actually saw several projects in process out there. Frankly, I read some of the descriptions. Some of them were close, but the way they were going about it was a bit different from the way I was looking at it. And quite frankly, I managed to get the functionality I wanted as was. You know, I managed to set it up very quickly, and I may very well go back there and try to put a nice little GUI on it. I do have a little tickle script that's a horrendous little thing that's mostly glommed off some other people's work, but it runs for the playback. And frankly, I don't need one at this point for record because I just set up the crontab file.
How does it change the channel?
In the script that's called Rec, and that's on the page, it uses one of the Video for Linux control commands that tells the tuner to change the channel. That's it. And then it uses Streamer from XAW TV to suck in the signal for so many minutes, whatever I tell it to do, and that's that. It's very straightforward.
The least straightforward part, that's the other thing, too, is that all the software that I'm using was included on the Mandrake CDs. The only thing I did is I have upgraded Zine to the latest version from Mandrake 9, simply because they fixed a couple of bugs, and that was nice, a couple other nice little features in there. So it was worthwhile, but everything was there for this solution. All I needed to do was to put together a few very small little scripts, throw a little GUI at it, and spend a few minutes hacking together some PRONTAB entries.
Well, you've inspired me. I happen to have kicking around my basement in Sony Vaio, and it's actually called a graphic workstation. I took it as a trade-in from one of my customers, and this computer has a lot of gadgetry loaded on it in terms of it's got a video capture card, it's got composite video in and composite video out. It's got a lot of bells and whistles for its age, but it's got a Pentium 266. You know, it's a pretty old machine, but this is certainly not a CPU-intensive application that you're doing. It's making a hard drive spin, so I think I will attempt your project myself.
Hey. One thing I will say, one of the things I didn't put into the article yet, sort of a strange little problem, but the fact that it is a second-generation Pentium equivalent box, it's using the now standard suggested on-off. That is that if the power goes out, and that happens around here, we get these little 5-second power glitches every couple of weeks, which is annoying as hell. But if the power goes out, then the box remains off, as opposed to first-generation Pentiums and earlier, which most of the time when the power would come back on would start the box back up, which would be ideal for this. So that is one little irritating thing, is that if we get a power glitch, someone's got to walk over and hit the on button to bring the machine back up.
Yeah, you may be able to do something about that in BIOS, too.
Yeah, although I'll tell you, the BIOS on this thing has been kind of unimpressive when I've gone through it all.
Yep.
I've seen better CMOS settings than what I'm looking at here.
Okay. Well, very cool. So after doing this, give us a general price tag of what you think you spent in terms of materials and time. To put this together?
Well, the materials is right around $300.
$300.
And
how much does a TiVo cost?
TiVo, I think, is $300 plus $13 a month.
Yes, plus $13 a month forever.
Yeah, I think they have a lifetime deal for like $250 or something.
Yeah,
like that.
But they also know who you are and know what you watch.
Yeah, and if they decide that
I find very spooky.
Yeah, and if they decide that they want to do something else for a living, then you're stuck with a box. Of course, the other thing too is with this high definition TV that keeps being threatened in the U.S. You know, who knows how long this is going to be a viable service? At least
it's not real in Washington.
Excuse me?
It's not real in Washington?
Well, it's out there, but I mean, there's been this threat that they're going to force everything into HDTV format
yep.
in another couple of years. And of course, should that finally occur, then I'm left with a little PC that I can.
Doc, are you still on?
I'm still here.
Yeah. Do you have HDTV stations?
No, I don't. I have a Dish TV, which is digital TV, but that only means that it's MPEG-2. It's just.
But do you know if any of the broadcasters in your area are broadcasting HDTV?
Oh yeah, there are. Most of the major metropolitan areas, there are. The stations are broadcasting. The major stations are also broadcasting, from time to time, not constantly, in what's called 1080i. It's 1080 1080 pixels high. I forget how wide it is. And I stands for interlaced, I think. And then there's a 1080 something else. R for raster. I don't know what it is. But anyway, there are a number of different display modes and so forth. But it's not. It's not. The interesting thing is that, and I was actually, my wife and I took the time to stop by a store in downtown Santa Barbara, and found that it looks beautiful. But the thing is, there just isn't that much there yet. But also, what the guy told us is that it's totally Osborne-ing all of the existing televisions. Why get one when they're outlawed after 2006? So the price on the displays are coming down real fast. But, you know, we're really at a kind of an in-between stage right now. And a big question mark is what's going to be the business model? Because the writing is on the wall for advertising-supported television, except for sports and news, which are live. You can TiVo sports if you want, but you got a bunch of people over, you know, you fall back in time. So the belief is that those things, the things that are, that the value of which decays in moments are still going to be advertising supported, but everything else is not. Ultimately, it's all going to turn into kind of a la carte subscription, HBO, etc. DRM'd out the yin yang, by the way. The MPAA can't wait for digital to happen for that reason.
Yeah.
In other words, the story with, the real story with the broadcasting is that the RIAA drove the deal with webcasters that they really wanted retrospectively originally with broadcasters. You probably saw that wonderful piece in The Onion, didn't you? Did you see it?
Yeah,
if you have any chance.
That was hilarious.
Oh my God! RIAA sues broadcasters for stealing.
Yeah. In fact, as a side note, that article at The Onion. I would really like to put on the next meeting of the AOTC as an agenda item to authorize the funding to print out, get permission from the Onion, and print out copies of that page on their website and send it to every congressman in Washington, D.C. I think it'd be a very funny educational piece.
Yep.
And then an introduction letter to the AOTC.
Right? Well, what these guys are going to want is whether you have a broadcast flag or not doesn't matter. I mean, right now, on the demand side, I am entirely at the mercy of Dish Network. And Dish Network and DirecTV both have high definition services.
Yep.
There's just not much on them yet.
Because I think Russ is right here. I think there's actually a market for devices, non-TiVo devices that could accommodate by, you know, just changing the capture card, which isn't, you know, a major infrastructure modification.
Right.
The device can go from SVGA to, you know, UVGA to some even higher standard, so that it can be used with the 1080i or with the HDTV standards, because these things are coming. There's a lot of broadcasting now going on with the high resolution digital and HDTV. Are you guys starting to see broadcasts in widescreen 1080i?
Yeah,
because that's the big thing here in Chicago right now, is that they're starting to broadcast in widescreen 1080i on digital cable networks.
Yeah, well, what's going to happen too is that it's probably within the next year or two they're going to be, laptops are going to be 1080 high, you know, with widescreen aspect ratios. That's the gating factor there is just making the screens and getting the screen prices down. But that standard has been set, and that's sort of a mark toward which some of these guys are bound to be heading. The thing is that, there's an opportunity for the kind of stuff Russ is doing now and for the hackers of the world to make hay while the sun shines, because what's going to happen once this thing goes downstream, is that, you know, the MPAA and the broadcasters are going to want to cartelize this whole thing,
yep.
just like they did with DVDs. And what we'll want to have happen is that we're ahead of the curve on this thing, and we'll be there waiting for them when they, you know, I mean, we will lobby to some degree and successfully
well,
to prevent that.
I'm going out this weekend and actually buying my first HDTV monitor.
Wow.
What
kind are you getting? What are you getting?
It's a Mitsubishi, and get this, this is incredible. It's 55-inch, $2,200.
Wow.
Isn't
is it projection or is it a...
Pardon?
What is the...
It's a tube. It's not liquid crystal.
Oh, it is a tube.
It's not
okay.
flat. It's flat screen, but it's not one of those... It's not a, it's, you know, a thin LCD type.
Uh-huh.
A plasma. It's a... That's a regular tube, but it's an HDTV tube, and it looks gorgeous, and it's only $2,200 for a 55-inch TV.
Well,
that's unbelievably cheap. So I'm taking the leap. Didn't think I would this soon, but I'm taking the leap. I love football, so what can I say? What can I say? They
yeah.
caught me. Russ, cool project. And like I said, you got me inspired. I'm going to go ahead and do one, give it a shot. So I'll be on the phone with you sometime soon going, Russ, help me.
It's actually not bad. The interesting thing, the thing that I was most surprised by is I mentioned this briefly inside my InfoWorld article that's, I think, out there this week. And the number of emails I've gotten from people saying, great article. Now, what about this TV thing here? Can you tell me how to do it? It's just been astounding. I've gotten probably 30 emails just on that subject in the past day and a half. So that's pretty wild. Apparently there are a lot of people that are interested in this.
Yeah, well, the demand's out there, isn't it? Well, gentlemen, we are up to 17 after the hour, so we're going to go ahead and stop here and move everything else, including this second project, to the next show. And who knows, maybe we'll have the guy from Microsoft on with us next week. We'll see what happens on that front. So all of you who are here to find out how to build a really cool kick-ass RAID 1 streaming server that is going to be used as a developmental platform for the Radio Free Universe project, you're going to have to wait until next week. There is a link on the Linux Show website in the links box right on the front page of the website, and it just says streaming server, and you can click on that and get a parts list of the rudimentary things you need to go buy to actually build this commercial class streaming server. You will note, if you do go look at the parts list, that there's no sound cards included, and I did that on purpose because we're going to be covering that on a later date. I don't want people to get too ahead because, well, Bill and I are still doing some experimenting, so I don't want people to go out and invest in SB Live cards if they don't need to, because they're not cheap. So we're going to call it a night then. Again, I'd like to thank Dennis Powell from Linux in Maine for stopping by and clarifying the stories that he has written in the past week. Glad to see that kind of quality of reporting within the Linux community. So on behalf of the entire crew here at the Linux Show, we'll catch everybody next week. Thanks for coming by in the IRC group. All you guys, all you girls out at the KDE League, don't you know, think bad things. Take heart. You stumbled. You haven't died. Pick yourselves up, dust yourselves off, and move on. No one hates you. You just made a couple of minor strategic management mistakes, but you'll live through them. So pick up and move forward. So we'll see everybody next week. Hang in there. We're out of here.
Yes, you too can sponsor The Linux Show. Here's an example. Insert your company name here. Is a valued sponsor of The Linux Show. Here's another example. Insert your company name here. Is bringing you this special segment of The Linux Show. Now, thanks for checking this out.